Hello and welcome everyone to episode 3 of the Odds and Ends podcast. Got Stephen Godowski on the show today. Stephen is somebody who I respect on opinions of geopolitics. He knows things I don't, and has been following the Ukraine war pretty closely. And I think I often let my nose dictate this one. I sort of think, well, if I wanted to chat with someone, I think most podcasts, I think the best kind of podcast is just a way of having conversations with people you wanted to have anyway. And I did want to have this conversation with Stephen. Stephen, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Keeping on, keeping on.
Playing, right?
You're kind of, I mean, the Godowski clan is kind of internet micro-celebrities as a brand. I don't know if we're going to be able to find the...
That's Alan Cole's fault.
I just enjoy, you know, there's the kid computer having a computer meme with this turns out to be Stephen's brother. And so whenever I see that, I think of that. We went to Capricorn and then it turned out you were like, well, hey, where is it? And I said, oh, it's here. And you were like, well, that's right by my parents' house.
Yeah, it turns out Brian Kaplan lives is next door neighbors with my parents.
I sort of expect kind of meme-y things to happen to you, I think. You're a person around who... So I guess to start off, what do you think is really important about the war in Ukraine? Like, what do you think are some important things that may or may not happen to kind of ground it for you? Know, what are some things which if a genie could come to you and say, like, this is what's going to happen in 6 months or a year's time, what are the events that you think are really important?
Well, I don't know how well I can predict exactly how it will come out.
I think you'll do it badly like all of us, so I wouldn't worry too much.
So, things I think are likely to happen. The Russians are likely to run very low on armored vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
They've had a challenge. So first off, at the initial part of the invasion, they had an excess of equipment, which was left over from Soviet times.
Is it?
And insufficient personnel to man it. And so from February to, let's say, maybe around the end of the offensive in Kharkiv, the Ukrainian counteroffensive in Kharkiv, they were making up for their deficit in personnel with profligate expenditure of ammunition and armored vehicles.
Okay.
And now, after they've mobilized, they have enough personnel, but they don't have enough equipment. They're pulling older and older armored vehicles out of storage. Their production rate can't keep up. The Ukrainians, in terms of maneuver forces, are rapidly reaching a sort of parity. In terms of artillery, it's a lot more questionable. Now, so I'm breaking down the types of forces here broadly into fire and maneuver, with artillery and air defense being fire, armor and infantry being maneuver. Russia has compensated for its lack of armored vehicles with extensive defensive works, trenches, minefields, ditches, and so on. And these have actually been very effective, which should come as no surprise.
So let's just pause there. This was a surprise to me in that, like, I've been looking, one of the Metaculus users, and we'll throw this in the notes, came to say that many large defensive works often slow people down only for sort of like, you know, sometimes as much as days, sometimes as much as half a year, but never really forever. I guess to me, that seemed to update me that at some point the defensive works will get broken through, but that's not your opinion.
So the thing about a defensive, they're called gaps or obstacles, right? An obstacle that is not being defended actively, it is a speed bump. But an obstacle that is being defended actively and, like, watched over can be extremely deadly. There's this idea that, like, for instance, World War One was a war of trench warfare and attrition, and then World War Two was a war of maneuver, and now maybe we're going back to trench warfare and attrition warfare, but I think this is inaccurate. By the way, this isn't directly answering your question, I'm sorry, but I think it's an important context.
Sure.
I think both of these things have always been with us.
Is it?
And it depends on the density of forces involved. There was trench warfare in the Second World War. There was maneuver warfare in the First World War. The thing about a trench is it... Trenches are actually extremely powerful defenses even now.
Is it?
The way... Especially in a war like this, which both of these armies, their tactics, their procedures, and their experience is largely in the heavy use of artillery. Suppose you're standing in an open field.
Is it?
And a shell explodes. You're just standing up and a shell lands in that field. The way the shell kills you is flying pieces of metal, the fragments from the shell case, zoom through the air. They can zoom up to like 500 yards. They can go a long way and they cut you to ribbons. If you're lying face down in the dirt when that happens, you might be okay. They'll sail over your head. If the shell is fused to explode above your head, it's called a variable time fuse. They're projected downwards, and then if you're laying down in a field, it still kills you. Now, if you're in a trench, which, if properly constructed, will have areas with overhead cover, then the shell basically has to land directly on top of you in order to kill you. And that's pretty unlikely. So a trench manned with personnel that's overlooking a ditch and a minefield that have to be cleared and crossed before the enemy can get to you. You can shoot the engineers as they're trying to get to you. You may have seen pictures before of like a bunch of Ukrainian fighting vehicles that were bunched up and attempting to cross a minefield. This happened a few weeks ago.
Yep.
That's the danger when you're trying to cross a gap that's defended, is that the defenders will just be able to destroy the equipment that you're using to try to cross it before you can get across it. This is a challenging problem. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think, therefore, my question is, like, what do you anticipate will be the case in, you know, let's say...
Yeah.
Let's say a month's 16th. Time, right? Let's say a month, and let's say by the end of the combat. So one month's time, and then...
I don't expect the Ukrainians to make, especially considering their progress so far in this offensive, I don't expect them to make major gains.
Right.
The Russians are absolutely not going to be able to... they don't have the manpower, and they don't have the armored vehicles necessary to engage in large-scale offensive operations. They pretty much shot their wad over the winter. So I expect the Russians will not make any new major advances at all. The Ukrainians might. They might achieve some kind of breakthrough. The difficulty is that things are slow going enough that it gives the Russians time to construct new defensive lines behind them.
Right. Okay. So maybe
if they
to like
wear out, it depends on how many Russians they manage to kill, basically. If they manage to weaken Russian forces through this offensive, and make no mistake, they're causing attrition, then they might be able to achieve a breakthrough.
So Tokmak, August the 1st, what are your feelings on that?
I'm hearing you say
that's pretty unlikely.
I believe that's a town about halfway to Melitopol, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Very
heavily fortified, already behind the lines.
I am, let's say, maybe a 25% chance the Ukrainians capture it.
Okay.
I don't think they're going to make
beginning of August, so maybe you want to go even lower.
This is right. This is just a month from now. I do not think that they're going to reach Tokmak by the 1st of August.
Okay. And then, you know, if we say Tokmak by the end of the year...
I don't know. Maybe somewhere between 25 and 50%. It's possible.
And what about... Land bridge? So, like, take it to cutting anywhere along...
Getting to Velikovol or to Berdyansk or to Mariupol.
Yeah, any way that they can split the two. So for anybody who's watching here, a land bridge is basically... We've got the delightfully named Deep State Map, which is a good thing to follow. I'll put that in the show notes. And the land bridge is basically, can they cut anywhere along here to split Russia into two areas?
Into a Crimean front and a Donbass front.
And a very weak Crimean front, because the bridge here seems pretty susceptible, maybe.
I want to push back on that a little bit. The bridge, the Kerch Strait, even if you were to take out the bridge, I don't think the Russians would be unable to supply their forces in the south.
Ooh, hello. That's a take.
I think that the Kerch Bridge is less important than it's made out to be.
Ooh, okay. What do you think? What are your land bridge thoughts? Give me some.
End of the year, if they get to Tokmak, then
we can do that. If they get to Tokmak,
there's a decent chance that they get the land bridge. But I have trouble assigning a specific number to this because I don't feel like I can say with much confidence at all what happens, because it really depends on whether the Russians mobilize again and how much attrition the Ukrainians manage to inflict.
Okay, but I'm hearing you think it's pretty unlikely. Is that fair?
I think at this point, absent a major change in... I don't want to say it's impossible.
Sure.
But I don't think it's a better than even chance that they take Melitopol, Mariupol, or Berdyansk by the end of the year.
For any of those?
Yeah.
It's okay.
But they could. I don't want to rule it out. Like, it very well could happen. And all this, like, depends on what kind of Western support they get. It depends on... it depends on, like, what the Russian response is.
Do you think they're going to take any kind of different position on the Antonov Bridge? I don't know if you've been following that. The Antonov Bridge, they've been taking sort of, they've crossed the Dnieper.
A large river crossing is in the cards. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it would be extremely unwise.
So you're maybe, I don't know, you're maybe sort of 1 in 10 there, 10 to 1 maybe?
So one possibility is that they might attempt a Dnieper crossing if they receive significantly more air defense assets. But I still think, the river is very wide. Containing a bridgehead would be relatively easy. And the thing about a bridgehead is you can make the crossing, but once you do, you're locked in place. And so they can get a bridgehead. But once they have the bridgehead, they can't supply it because they're locked into that position, and that can be targeted with long-range fire from Russia. Artillery, missiles, precision-guided weapons. The Russians would probably be able to contain a bridgehead across the Dnieper without too much difficulty. So I think it would be an inefficient use of their resources. So I do not think they're going to make... Now, that doesn't prevent them from having small-scale raids, the purpose of which would be to, like, push Russian forces away from the river, give them some breathing space, reduce the artillery fire on Kherson and other cities. But I don't think they're going to cross in force and use that as a launch pad for further offensive operations at all.
Do you think they're going to get a lot more air defense? Or do you think that's the thing that's going to happen?
They're getting it in dribs and drabs. The problem is there's just not that much to go around. U.S. Patriot batteries, for instance, even before the war. I have a couple of friends who are air defense artillery officers. Those guys get deployed more than anyone else. There aren't enough. There's not enough equipment. There's not enough manpower. We desperately need all of our Patriot batteries, and even one battery was barely what we could afford to spare in the United States. And in Europe, it's maybe even worse. So they're getting what is available, and unfortunately, that's not a lot.
So your sense of this is that the Russians are kind of running out of armored, running low on armored vehicles.
They're out of steam.
You don't think there's going to be a lot of territory taken on either side. There's
I
some
think it's
chance.
Largely going to be a stalemate for the foreseeable future until
there's
one
some
side...
chance of a big breakout, but not a lot. You know, you think, and then I guess you think this just like runs into next year. Maybe they get a lot more troops. Maybe this is a war of attrition. Maybe the US stops support. You know, the US and Europe and you know the UK and Germany stop supporting, and then it goes badly for the Ukrainians. Is that like sort of roughly what you see? Are there any things that you think are like kind of wild card or underrated?
Some wild cards. This is looking less likely than before, but China, if China supports Russia, then that's curtains for Ukraine. China can supply Russia with a lot of the things that they're short of, like artillery ammunition. If the provision of DPICM cluster munitions definitely improves Ukraine's chances a lot, because that's a large supply of shells, which was previously untapped. And artillery ammunition is really the constraining factor in this war right now.
So, however, you think if there was sort of unlimited ammunition, then that would be...
If Ukraine had practically unlimited ammunition and artillery pieces, then they would have a very good shot of pushing the Russians out.
Right, okay.
But that's not available.
Yeah.
Now, the production of artillery ammunition is something that I think could be scaled up faster, given more money. But that's not happening yet. The Europeans are investing a lot of money in scaling up artillery ammo over the next year. So that won't pay off until next year. Next year, if the war continues into next year and the levels of support remain the same, I think Ukraine ultimately does sort of crack the Russians apart.
Okay.
But it's going to be slow going. Sorry, if this isn't the sort of format that you're expecting, by the way, for...
I think we're very... This is only episode number 3, so we are, you know, we're learning as we go.
Right.
Once, you know, episode 101, then we'll know what we're doing.
Right.
So I don't know. So maybe I'm hearing, like... what do you think the chances that supply levels stay the same next year?
There seems to be no wavering of support from Europe. And in the United States, there's been some concern about the Republican Party, but what we're seeing is that within Congress, there are the votes to provide funds for Ukraine. I think that the United States is going to pass another large package for support sometime this summer. And that will get them to next fiscal year.
So maybe you're sort of saying, I guess we consider it like China's pretty unlikely, right? Like, I don't know.
Yes, it looks like China's not really interested in helping Russia out.
So, you know, maybe we're going to say, like, you're sort of saying if the supply is the same and China stays out of it, then...
Then I think Ukraine is in a good position long term. But it is a long term thing.
Yeah, then you know, would you expect maybe the land bridge to be taken not this year, but by the end of next year?
Yes, I would expect the Ukrainians to eventually reach Berdyansk or Melitopol sometime next year if things continue. The Russians continue to suffer this kind of attrition. The Ukrainians continue to get reinforced with new vehicles, new ammunition, new artillery pieces, and so on.
Right, okay. I think... I think for the last 10 minutes, it might be just interesting, I think, to pull out some of the other, the other models we have. So we had Scott Eastman on the show a couple of weeks back, probably longer than that, in fact. So, you know, I think we've got to give Scott, you know, so we've got to be kind to Scott here because things have moved on. But Scott's general thesis seemed to be that if at this point we'd seen any sort of significant land take, if we'd gotten through any of the significant ground defenses, then he was really quite optimistic.
If they breached the initial lines.
Yeah. But I think, you know, I mean, I think already his sort of 75% taking the land bridge this year feels pretty high. I'm going to assume that I think that. I don't know if you do. I assume you do.
I mean, sometimes things just happen slowly than all at once. 75% is higher than I would rate it. Yeah. I don't
want to. I think
it's
probably higher than Scott will give it now, though. I don't know. Let's see. So you think a disagreement here seems to be that for him, if they took the land bridge, then, like, there was a pretty good chance of taking Sevastopol maybe this year, maybe a quarter chance,
so,
and then a bigger chance. But you seem to disagree with that.
I don't think, I'll be straight with you, I don't think Ukraine will take Sevastopol. And the reason is because, well, it pains me to say this, I don't think Ukraine wants Crimea back badly enough to pay the blood and treasure necessary to take it. And one of the ways I see this ending is a negotiated settlement in which everyone agrees to recognize Russian control of Crimea. Ukraine, look, while the annexation of Crimea was an outrage, and we cannot, like, condone revanchist moving borders around and so forth, there are many ways in which Ukraine is better off without Crimea. And a lot of the people in Crimea, it's not true that people in Ukraine proper want to be part of Russia. But in 2014, it was true that a lot of people in Crimea, I don't know if it was a majority, but a lot of them did want to be part of Russia. Especially part of if Ukraine was going to align with the West. And that's not legitimation for secession, but it does reduce, I think, Ukraine's politics are a lot more functional without the pro-Russian voters. Does that make sense?
So you really think...
I think Ukraine would trade away Crimea in return for peace, honestly. And they're not going to say that out loud. And if you ask the Ukrainians, they're going to honestly tell you, yeah, we're going to get all our territory back. But you, I am sure, are aware of the difference between stated and revealed preferences. And I think the revealed preference is going to end up being that they give up Crimea in return for everything else.
Okay. And, okay. So...
Also, fighting for Crimea... Now, that doesn't mean they couldn't fight for Crimea and trade it back, but fighting for Crimea might be challenging because of the terrain and because of the natural barriers of the isthmus and so on.
Okay. I mean, do you have any sense about, I mean, do you have a sense of Putin being in power at the end of the year? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think Putin probably does survive. It's less likely now than it was. In particular, I think Putin is a relatively savvy guy when it comes to maintaining his power base, and I think he prioritizes that above the war. I think that's extremely clear from the fact that he started the invasion without mobilizing conscripts. He's continued to refuse to mobilize the conscripts. He waited to mobilize until, like, the absolute last possible moment, which cost him Kharkiv. And he still hasn't mobilized again, even though the Russians are again running out of manpower. He clearly prioritizes his own political survival above winning the war. And so that means that if the war starts to go badly, he's not going to gamble his own survival on victory in order to achieve victory.
Okay. Final question then. What about tactical nukes? Are you somebody who believes there's sort of...
I think there's zero chance of that happening, almost.
You're 0.1, 0.01 kind of thing.
I don't like trying to estimate to that level of precision.
You're really saying it's extremely unlikely.
Discounting the possibility of tactical nuclear weapons. And what I will say is if Russia does use tactical nuclear weapons, it will rapidly lose. That is why I think they won't use them. The reason is that it is very clear that so the current implicit deal is that the West and NATO will not intervene directly. We won't send our own jet fighters over and bomb them. Because then they might use nuclear weapons. But the flip side of that is they won't use nuclear weapons because then we can send our jet fighters over and bomb them. Does that make sense? That's the equilibrium we've reached. And maybe you can push on the margins a little bit about how much support, right? But I think that's pretty... Right now, Russia would be rapidly defeated by a direct NATO intervention, and the nuclear weapons wouldn't save them. In particular, because if they start nuking NATO countries, then they get nuked as well. And Putin cares about his survival to the point that he doesn't want to get turned into a radioactive parking lot. It's a stable equilibrium. That we don't intervene and they don't use nukes. I just don't see it happening. It does not benefit Putin to open that. To ring that bell.
Okay. We haven't on this show really developed what the final question is going to be, but we'll go for a new one. What do you think, on a larger geopolitical scale, what do you think is the most underrated thing? What do you think is the thing that most people aren't thinking about? Most people in our sort of spaces, what do you think the thing that they don't know that they ought to know? What's the thing that you know that they don't know?
So I don't know if other people don't know this, but I think the most important thing about this is that Russia's military was only powerful due to a large endowment of stuff it inherited from the Soviet Union, which is now expended. And what this war has done is burned off all of the stuff the Soviet Union spent 20% of its economy building over 50 years. It's gone, or close to gone. And that eliminates Russia as a serious threat to Europe as long as they're still fighting in Ukraine. And so for Europe, it's been terrible for Ukraine, but it's been fantastic for American and European foreign policy. And it's an unforced error by Putin, completely. For a long time, I have been worried about Russia invading Ukraine at the same time that China invades Taiwan. And Russia has allowed the United States to defeat its enemies in detail.
And so your opinion is really, unless Russia starts building a sort of like a military manufacturing base, which can actually start to supply these. So you're just like, Russia is just, other than
Russia's
on the nuclear
military
front,
is
Russia, unless they launch a nuke, in which case, that's terrible. But beyond that, they're just out of it as a serious, like, threatening world power for you, unless they get hugely supplied by China, which I guess is sort of saying China's really the one to watch at this point. As far as you're concerned, Russia's just out of it, it's just out of the kind of picture.
Russia will not be able to threaten NATO seriously for a very long time, perhaps as long as 10 or more years, maybe longer. They just don't. Russia is half the population of the Soviet Union, and it contributes maybe a quarter of the relative proportion of GDP towards defense that the Soviet Union did, maybe less. And as a result, they just don't have the ability to build back up the forces they had before the war. They have expended themselves. And that's an important point for geopolitics. For one thing, in the long run, it makes it much easier for the West to contain China because they don't have to watch two different fronts.
Okay.
I think that's an important point to consider.
I think I think our probability map, and this isn't Stephen's fault, I think this is largely just me trying to be better at this, isn't what I'd hoped for necessarily, so, you know, I'll have to apologize to viewers for that. I think it's a learning, every day's learning day, so I'm pretty yeah, relaxed so regardless.
I'm not saying it's part of my fault. I'm not accustomed to this sort of...
No. I don't believe that for a moment. I really don't. I think no one's accustomed to it. I got someone to build it for me according to my specifications, so it's new stuff. We're trying out a process here. But I did really appreciate just a huge amount of knowledge and stuff that I didn't know. So I'm really glad we had this chat. Thank you so much, Stephen, for coming on the show.
Of course.
And certainly in the last point we discussed, I hope you're right. I mean, that seems like quite an optimistic point, I think. Thank you so much. And I wish you, I think it's earlier in Stephen's day than is mine. So I wish you
Just afternoon here. It's right about lunchtime.
Afternoon. Thanks very much.
Have a good evening, Nathan. See you around.
Bye.